So what I'd like to do today is discuss the role of Jerusalem, physical Jerusalem and the spiritual Jerusalem in Judaism, with some comments contrasting it with the role of Jerusalem in Christianity and in Islam. And along the way, we will learn a Gemara, a Rashi, and a Tosfot. Now, you all know that in the political atmosphere in which we now operate, we hear that Jerusalem is sacred to the three monotheistic religions. Arguably a problematic phrase to begin with. And you also know, I don't have to preach to the converted, that the argument that Jerusalem has a comparable role in Islam and in Christianity to the one that it has in Judaism is almost comical. Under the circumstances, I suppose ludicrous is a better term than comical, because it's not altogether funny. So let me say something about its role in the two other religions, beginning with Christianity, which of course comes before Islam. Christianity took a position on physical manifestations of religiosity that was self-consciously different from the position of Judaism. It may not really be that different, but in terms of the Christian self-perception, Christianity is the religion of the spirit, while Judaism is the religion of the physical. There's a carnal Israel versus a spiritual Israel. And there is also a physical Jerusalem and a spiritual Jerusalem. One would expect, there is a verse in the New Testament, in Galatians, that speaks about the Jerusalem above. So that in Christian texts, we have the assertion that the Jerusalem above is the mother of us all. We have an image of an end of days in which the heavenly city of Jerusalem comes down again from heaven, though it is a Jerusalem without a temple. That's explicit in the relevant New Testament verse. There will not be a temple in the Jerusalem that comes down from heaven at the end of days. Now, one would think that a religion which devalued the physical and replaced it, as it were, with the spiritual, which of course was part of the Christian self-conception regarding most of the ritual mitzvot, would also marginalize the city of Jerusalem, the physical city, and the land of Israel itself. And in pure theory, this was the case. But in reality, it actually wasn't the case quite as much as one would think. So that pilgrimages became a central element, maybe central is too strong, but became an important element of Christian piety in the Middle Ages. People are going to go to the land of Israel, and particularly to the city of Jerusalem, as a manifestation of their Christian piety. The question is why? I mean, why is this important? And there are some interesting discussions of this among the church fathers where the tension is clearly evident. They don't think this should be important. And some of them actually are dismissive of this whole enterprise. But at the same time, the fascination of Jerusalem somehow could not be completely exorcised. And so one of the church fathers who was most strident in his dismissive attitudes toward pilgrimage, then says, it's true that I went on a pilgrimage myself, but, and he tries to explain it away. Having said all of this, the fact still remains that for Christianity, the spiritual Jerusalem, the Jerusalem in the heaven, the Jerusalem above, played a greater role in the religious imagination than any kind of physical Jerusalem. And we know even that the Crusaders, some of them, thought that they were going to the land of Israel, where they would see the heavenly Jerusalem. The earthly Jerusalem took not second place and not even third place in the Christian religious imagination. There was an exchange that I was told about once by Chaim Soloveitchik. He said he was watching a TV interview that involved both an American diplomat. This was quite a number of years ago, so the American diplomat, who was not a young man, would have already been at an age when he could have been aware of what's going on at the end of World War I. And then there was an Israeli diplomat who he thinks was Abba Ibn. And the American diplomat, who was a Christian, said that the role of Jerusalem in Christianity is comparable to its role in Judaism. To which the Jewish diplomat, whether it was Ibn or someone else, turned to him and said, tell me, do you remember the day when General Allenby conquered Jerusalem? Right. The end of World War I, a Christian general marched into Jerusalem and restored it, as it were, if you want to use that word, to Christian control for the first time since the 12th century. And the American responded, as was obvious he would, no, I don't remember that day. To which the Israeli diplomat responded, there is not a single committed Jew who was of the age of awareness on the second day of the Six-Day War who does not remember that day. Now, in Islam, Jerusalem is, if anything, even more marginal, although there is a genre of literature of poems which doesn't exist throughout the history of Islam. But there was a point where there was a genre of poems about Al-Quds, about the city of Jerusalem. It does play some role, some really quite marginal, but real role, in Islamic piety. As you probably know, there is a story about how Muhammad was miraculously transferred to the farthest mosque, and from there was raised up to heaven at one point. And some, you know, later Muslim tradition identifies the farthest mosque with the Har HaBayit, and this led to a line by a Jewish professor, a Hebrew University professor, R.J. Tzvi Wroblewski, is reported to have said that there are apparently no non-stop flights from Mecca to heaven. You have to travel via Jerusalem. Jerusalem was never turned into an important city politically in the history of Islam. Judaism, of course, is a different story. I'd like to talk a bit about the notion, not so much of a heavenly city, and also a heavenly temple, and an earthly city, and an earthly temple. In Judaism, including in Chazal, it is the Jerusalem on earth that matters most. There is even a line in the Gemara in Tanis, Daf Hei, Amud Aleph, which mentions Yerushalayim Shel Mala, and that's not the Gemara you have here. The Gemara actually asks at one point, Mi'ika Yerushalayim Yamala, is there a Jerusalem above? And the answer is yes, but the question underscores the marginal character of that concept. And in other rabbinic texts, there are assertions that God left the heavenly temple to dwell in the earthly one, and so on. Now, this distinction between a heavenly temple and an earthly one is one that I think mirrors a different, perhaps more important, distinction involving the active role of Jews, who after all live in a physical world, in bringing about the restoration of that temple. And in this context, I'd like to look at the Gemara that you have in front of you, and a Rashi and a Tosfot. So first, we actually have to look at the Gemara itself in order to see what I'm interested in, which is how the heavenly temple sort of became important in certain strains of Jewish messianic expectation or messianic scenarios. I think, you know, something interesting emerges out of this discussion in the Gemara. So take a look at this page that you have, which is the Daf Mem Aleph, Amud Aleph of Sukkah. And we'll begin with the passage that quotes the Mishnah, V'sheyehe Yom HaNeif. Now, if we first go back to the Mishnah itself, one of the takanot that the Mishnah says Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai introduced was that Yehe Yom HaNeif Kulo Asu. So what that means is, as Rashi explains, that the 16th day of Nisan, which is the day of the bringing of the Omer, Omer HaTenufa, is one on which one may not eat chadosh all day. Now, chadosh, as you know, I would not have said as you know if I were talking when I was your age, because when I was your age, people in the Orthodox community, most of them anyway, didn't even know what chadosh is. I remember that I was in a shiur with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik when I was a sophomore in college, and he mentioned chadosh, and nobody in the shiur knew what it was, and he was horrified. Because the Soloveitchiks, most of them, were very makrid on not eating chadosh, but B, because you know, this is a pasuk in Chumash. This is, doesn't require great learning. And you know, I could have recited the two relevant psukim with the truck by heart, but along with every single one of my classmates, I just didn't recognize what the term meant. I mean, nobody avoided chadash in those days, it wasn't a concept that we grew up with. So I heard about chadash for the first time when I was a sophomore in college, Chodesh, for those of you who need a definition, is the is grain that took root after the 16th of Nisan, and for the remainder of that year until the following 16th of Nisan, when it becomes permissible. Right, lechem v'koliv v'charmel lo sochlu ad etzem hayom hazeh ad habiyacheves kavan elokei etchem, etc. Now. Mida Oraisa, one may start eating what was chadosh from the moment the Omer is actually brought in the temple, sometime during the 16th of Nisan, and that's Yom HaNeif. However, once the temple was destroyed, the Gemara tells us why Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai prohibited eating chadosh the entire day of the 16th. Remember, the Omer wasn't going to be brought anymore. Now, the assumption of the Gemara at this point is that min haTorah, it would be permissible to eat chadosh from the morning of the 16th if the Omer is not going to be brought at all. Because once there's no temple, then it's permissible to eat chadosh as of daybreak on the 16th of Nisan. And as a takana, Rabbi Nachman ben Zakkai prohibited people from eating chadosh for the entire day. So the Gemara said, my Tama, why did Rabbi Yochanan, that's actually, did you see that? That meant at the beginning of a line, at least on my Gemara, the beginning of a line, I don't know if it's the beginning of a line in yours. Right after Sheyehei Yom HaNev. My Tama, what's the reason for this Takana? Meheroi Boneh Beis HaMikdosh, the temple, you know, should soon be rebuilt. V'yomru, and people will say, Eshtokeh Milo Achalnu Beheir Mizroch. Last year, did we not eat Chodosh? The moment of daybreak. And so this year too, we will start eating chadosh in the morning. And they will not realize, they won't know, the eshtokeh, the law of Beis HaMikdosh, last year when there was no temple, daybreak permitted the eating of what was chadosh. Hashta, the Ikar Beis HaMikdosh, now that there is a temple, Omer Matir. You have to wait until the Omer is brought. And so to prevent this error from being made in the first year in which the Beis HaMikdosh will be rebuilt, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai prohibited people throughout the period of exile, as long as it would last, from eating Chadosh all day on the 16th. So the Gemara asks, the Ivnei Amos, when are we assuming the temple will have been rebuilt? Ilema the Ivnei Vishitsar, if the concern is that it will be built on the 16th of Nisan itself, Harehi Tirhe Ir Mizroch. At daybreak, when there was no temple yet, Chodesh became permissible. And therefore, there's nothing to worry about. If they ate in the morning, that's fine. So there's no reason for the takana. Ela, the Ibnei Bachamisar, Mechatzos Hayom Lahalon. I'm sorry, Ela, the Ibnei Bachamisar, let's say it was built on the 15th, or as Rashi says, or earlier. Mechatzos Hayom Lahalon Tishtari. It should be permissible to eat chadosh beginning at midday. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, if he's going to make a gezeirah, should have only made this takana to prohibit eating chadosh during the exile in the morning. Why? Because the hatznan, harachokim, this is when there is a temple, people who are very far away from the temple and won't know exactly when the omer was brought, Mutarim mechatzos hayom lahalon, they are allowed to eat what was chadosh beginning at midday. Lefisha'en beistim misatzlim bo. The people in charge are careful to bring the omer as promptly as possible, and therefore by midday you can be sure that they already brought it. So, if Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was going to make a takana prohibiting the eating of chadosh on the day of the 16th, lest people make a mistake the year the temple is rebuilt, then he should have prohibited it only in the morning. Because when the temple is rebuilt, it will be fine if people eat chadosh in the afternoon. So why did he have to make a gezeirah prohibiting it all day? And the Gemara replies, Lo Sricha, the Ivnei Vileya. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's concern was that the Beis HaMikdosh will have been built the evening, the night of the 16th, in other words, the leading into the 16th, Inami, or Somuch Lishkiya Satama, on the 15th, close to sunset, which is a way of saying that in either case, the preparation of the Omer would not have begun until very late in the game, and there might not be time to prepare it by midday of the 16th. So in that first year, when the temple is rebuilt, we may have a unique situation in which the Omer would not be brought until after midday. And therefore, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai forbade people from eating Chadash all day the 16th in the exile, lest in that first year they would eat Chadash before the Omer would be brought, even in the early afternoon. Maybe it would not have been brought by then because of the exigencies of limited time. That's the Gemara. That's the relevant Gemara for us. Now, there is something problematic about this Gemara, since it assumes that the temple will be built at night, might be built at night, or that it might be built on the 15th of Nisan in the afternoon. And the reason why this is a problem is formulated by Rashi in a Rashi that begins Inami, which is not in your printout because of a mistake of mine. I didn't make clear that the Rashi of Inami is not the Rashi of Inema. And therefore, there's a Tosfot Inami, which is on your page, which we will look at. But there's a Rashi Inami below the bottom of the page that you have, that was cut off. So I will have to read it to you, even though you won't have it in front of you. Then we will look at the Tosfot together. Rashi raises a question from from another Gemara. And it's a question that, it's not the common thing Rashi usually does. Rashi doesn't usually worry about contradictions from other Gemaras. This, you know, everybody who has studied medieval Jewish history and the YU system knows that Tosfot introduced the dialectical method in the study of the Gemara. Rashi didn't do this. Rashi studied the sugya in itself as it sits before you. Tosfot, scoured the entire Talmud to find the contradictions to be resolved. This is a contradiction that is so blatant that Rashi ignored what the later historians said about him, which is a serious problem. I think Rashi would have to have had some deductions made on his perush here by historians who would say that, no, this is not what Rashi does, but he did it anyway. And what he said is, there's another Gemara that says that you're not allowed to build the temple at night. You're not allowed to build the temple on Yom Tov. And the 15th of Nisan in the afternoon is the first day of Pesach, or of Chag HaMatzot, if you prefer to be technical about it. I'll read it to you. The Ikashya, if you ask the question, right, this is what Tosfos is supposed to say, but Rashi says it. The Valayla Inonivnet, the temple cannot be built at night. The Kaimalan Bishvuol, Staf Tesvav on the Beit, the Ein Binyan Beis HaMikdosh Balayla, Vichsiv Uviyom Hakim. And Rashi goes on, and also, the Loba Chamisar, you also can't build a temple on the 15th, Shehu Yom Tov. The Kaimalan Bishvuos, also right there. The Ein Binyan Beis HaMikdosh Toche Yom Tov. So Rashi's answer to this question is, Hane Mile, what the Gemara in Shavuos says about not building the temple at night or during the day, or rather on Yom Tov. Hane Mile Binyan HaBanui Bidei Adam. This refers to a building that is built by human hands. Avol Mikdosh HaOsid, the future temple, She'anu Mitzapin, that we are waiting for. Banui U'Meshuchlal Hu Yigolevi Avol Mishamayim. That is going to be revealed and come from heaven, fully built. She'ne'emar Mikdosh Hashem Konenu Yodecha. Verse from Shirat HaYam. And so Rashi says that the final temple is going to come down from heaven miraculously, And hence, that could happen at night or on Yontif, because it's not actually being built. There's no Chilul Yontif involved, and there's no building at night. It's simply God is bringing it down from heaven miraculously. Now, I think it's fair to say that Rashi's prior assumption in this discussion was that the temple would be built by human hands. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had a question in the first place. I mean, you could say that that this is just a literary device of his to make the point, and it says, you might ask, and I'll answer. But still, the straightest reading is that even Rashi came to this Gemara with the prior assumption that the temple would be built by human hands. And he resorted to this midrashic assertion as a way of resolving a problem. I think that this is even clearer in Tosafot, that this is not, it wasn't their instinctive assumption that the final temple is going to come down from heaven. The Tosafot you do have, okay, the one that begins Inami. Inami samuch lishkiya satan lo adavta misa. Close to the setting of the sun, and the Hamisa probably should not be in bold. Do you have it in bold? You do have it in bold. I think it probably should not be in bold. Because yeah, I mean, now Gemara says Inami Samach Lishkiya Sachama, and the whole point of this is so we're assuming it's the 15th, right? And Tosfos says Shlo Yichuli Yisaseik Omer B'Skuas Laila. They won't be able to work on the Omer, at the very beginning of the night, and they won't Lagaspikol Haku Kodem Chatzos L'Machar, and it won't be brought before midday the next day. And since this is something we already know, and then they explain why it should take so much time to do. And then, they say, I have to read something that I said. After Kodom Chatzos L'machar, right? The Yesh Meforshim, the Ma'irei Be'erev Yom Tov, Samach L'Shkiyas Hachama, doesn't mean right before sunset on the 15th. It means close to sunset on the 14th. But that still wouldn't give them time to prepare it properly by the 16th. And those are the lines that I'm prepared to skip now. But the initial interpretation in this Tosfot is that Samuch Lishkiyat HaChama means close to sunset on Erev, what we call Erev Pesach, Erev Chag HaMatzot, the 14th. Why? And now I'm continuing with the words Di'i Samuch, which is right after the reference to Menocho, Staf Samuch Vav Omer Aleph. Di'i Samuch Lishkiyat HaChama D'Chamisar Ko'omar, if it really means close to the, shortly before sunset of the 15th, Shehu Yom Tov, Ha Ein Binyan Beis HaMikdash Lo Chayom Tov. You're not allowed to build it then. Pidi Isa Perek Sheni Bishvos, which was what Rashi pointed to. And Tosos responds to this by saying, V'lav Pircho Yisif Shimon, this is not a proper question. Why? Because the Gemara says, the Gemara also says that the concern is that it would be built at night. But we also said over there in Shavuos, So saying that the Samach Lishkiyas HaChama means on the 14th, in order to avoid the problem of building the temple on Yom Tov, doesn't help you, because it doesn't account for the other line, the other words in the Gemara, namely that you're worried about it being built at night, which is equally prohibited. Ela aparachach, and therefore you have no choice but to say, tzarich lechalei kemo sheperish pakuntris, you have to say what Rashi said. V'hani milei binyan ha'boni v'gei odon, avon mikto she'osi boni v'shucho yigod v'yom na'shanayim, she'en ma'an v'dosh ha'shanchen v'dach. So Tosfot is kind of forced into Rashi's interpretation because the first answer does not account for the concern of building at night. I think it's fair to say that this formulation indicates very clearly not only that Tosfot's first assumption is not that the temple will come down from heaven, but that there were people in Tosfot's society, the ones who are the Yesh Mefarshim, who not only had their first assumption that the temple would be built by human hands, but it was also their operative assumption. The temple was going to be built by human hands, and therefore they interpreted the Shkiat HaChama phrase to refer to the 14th in order to avoid a problem. In other words, I don't think, and there's a scholarly dispute about this actually, I don't think that even Ashkenazic Jews intuitively, instinctively, as a first assumption, assumed that the final temple would come down from heaven. This is a position that they were kind of forced to embrace by a powerful question that arose out of a Gemara that seems to contradict a halacha formulated in a different Gemara. Now, as I said, there are people who don't agree with me about the assertion that Ashkenazic Jews did not, as their intuitive first assumption, operate with this miraculous descent of the temple. But at least as I read these texts, even Rashi and surely Tosfot, it seems pretty clear that was not their first assumption, that the first assumption was the naturalistic one. Now, the Rambam does say clearly, in more than one place, that the final temple will be built by human hands. Now, the Rambam didn't write a parish on the Gemara, and therefore we don't know how he handled this problem in the Gemara and Sukkah. And there's a parallel sugya elsewhere. One, shall we say, Maimonidean-style rationalist did write a perush, pretty much a perush, on the Gemara, you know, not quite line for line, but close enough, and that's the Meiri. And so, the question is, what's he going to do with this problem if he assumes that the temple will be built by human hands? And there is a striking explanation, at least to me, a striking explanation in the Meiri that says something about the difference in openness toward buildings descending from heaven between Maimonidean rationalists and Ashkenazic Jews in the Middle Ages. This is the Meiri's comment on this Gemara. The Meiri says that the Gemara refers to the possibility that the final temple will be built at night or on Yontif, even though both of those options are forbidden, because we are choshesh levesdin to'im she mechibas hamikdosh. They will build it at a time when it's forbidden to build it. In other words, this is my paraphrase, but I think it's a fair paraphrase. The Meiri proposes that the Beis Din that is under the supervision of the Melech HaMashiach will make a gross error in an ofen halacha, so that he can avoid bringing down buildings from heaven. I think that that's a fair affirmation of what's happening here. Rashi's explanation is far better than the Meiri's if we're looking simply at its plausibility as an explanation. If you have an option of a temple coming down from heaven, so we're talking about an event that involves no error and no violation of halacha at all, and the other option, the alternative, is to say that the Beit Din in Messianic times is going to make a gross halachic error. Rashi's interpretation is certainly preferable to that, I think, unless you are not willing to bring down buildings from heaven. And if you are not willing to bring down buildings from heaven, you are stuck and you have to seek some other explanation. And this is the Meiri's explanation. I should say that the Temple from Heaven explanation, once it entered the mainstream of Jewish thought through Rashi and Tosfot, became highly influential, even in non-Ashkenazic circles, so that there is a comment made by Rav Yosef Yavetz, one of the Golei Sfarad, responding to a Christian argument that there will never be a third temple. Christians cited a verse in Chagai that says, "Gadol yiyeh kvod habayis hazeh ha'acharon min harishon," that the honor of this, well, last temple will be greater than that of the first. And of course he's talking about the second temple. So since acharon usually means last and nothing afterwards, that shows that the second temple will be the final temple. This was a Christian argument used by medieval Christians. And Jews answered whatever they answered. I'll tell you in a moment what their Jewish answers were. But Rav Yosef Yavetz proves to his satisfaction that this Christian interpretation has to be wrong. Because, he says, there must be a third temple. How do I know? Because it says, Mikdash Hashem konenu yadecha, that a temple is going to be constructed by the hands of God himself. And the second temple was built by human hands. In other words, he takes the position that a temple will miraculously come down from heaven as so compelling, based after all on this explicit pasuk, as it were, that he even thinks that this argument will carry weight with Christians. Now that is how deeply this option was internalized by at least one medieval non-Ashkenazic Jew. I suppose I should have a kind of obligation to tell you how Jews answered this Christian argument in a more direct way. Jews had two verses they could cite that showed that Acharon can refer to a second, after which there is a third. So one of the verses was, I don't know if this is really an example of a second followed by a third. Well, yeah, it is. V'leyo uvaneha acharonim, v'rochel v'yosef acharonim. When Yaakov arranges the order of his family, when Esau is going to be confronting him, he places Leah and her children last, and Rachel and Yosef last. It's in that context that Rashi cites the adage Acharon, Acharon Chaviv, which in this case, you know, we just use it to mean the very last. But here you have an Acharon and another Acharon. But the most striking analogy that Jews found was when God gives Moshe various signs, and the word used is otot, right? Osos. To bring to the Jewish people. And he tells them, you should pour water down, it'll turn into blood. And then he tells them, you should put your hand under your garment and bring it out and it will become leprous. And then bring it back and it will become cured. And then, I'm sorry, the first thing is the serpent, not the blood. The first sign is that you should throw down the staff and it should turn into a serpent. The second one is that you should put your hand under your garment and it will be leprous and then will be cured after you do this again. And then the verse says, V'haya lo ya'aminu l'kol ha'os ha'rishon, v'ha'aminu l'kol ha'os ha'acharon. If they won't believe the first sign, they will believe the last sign. If they don't believe either of these, I'll give you a third. And the third is that you should pour the water down, it will become blood. So you see that there is a first and a last, Haron, and a third, exactly as will be the case, said Jews, with the temple. There's a very cute line that is ascribed to the Gra, but as usually is the case, when I ask Professor Schneer Lyman about this, he knows of an earlier case than the Gra, someone who said this, essentially because he knows everything. But in any case, this is the line. It's worthy of the Gra anyway. I mean, it's a cute line. It's not a serious argument. It's very cute. That, he said, is the deeper meaning of the verse, V'hayah hadam lachem la'os al habotim. The blood, which was the third sign given to Moshe, will serve as an os, right? Lo hamin l'kol ha'os ha'rishon l'kol ha'charon. If I'll give you a third, that the blood will be an os for you, al habotim, regarding the Batei Mikdash, regarding the temple, the temples, and you will be able to cite this verse in responding to Christians. In any event, the issues surrounding the heavenly temple, the miraculous descent of the temple, really point to a much larger issue as well. I mean, it's an intrinsically relevant discussion, you know, to understanding the Gemara and to understanding how Jews saw the end of days, but it has larger implications. In the case of the Meiri's example, the implications have to do with rationalism. But this has implications with respect to religious Zionism as well. And it's not surprising that someone like Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who is most important, probably, proto-Zionist rabbi, was disturbed by this Gemara in Sukkah. To him, human initiative was highly relevant in the process of redemption. There will be, to use the Kabbalistic terms that are found in a number of such contexts, including in Kalischer, there will be an Is Arusa di Lisata, there will be an arousal from below, which will lead to an Is Arusa di La'elo, which will lead to an arousal in the divine realm. And from that perspective, miraculous redemption that happens without human activity is problematic. Now, of course, you can say that there will be human initiative, but not with respect to this particular point. But the building of the temple is a big deal. And in the case of Rav Kalischer himself, he also had an idiosyncratic interest in starting to bring sacrifices even before the temple is physically built. And so for him, the human initiative element in all this is relevant also to the building of the temple, or at least the reintroduction of the sacrificial order. There is certainly more to be said about this whole issue of human versus divine initiative here. So I'll just, end without going into detail with the following more or less self-evident points. Religious non-Zionism took the position that the Jewish people simply have to wait. Secular Zionists, of course, had no divine intervention that they could wait for, and so they took the position that if Jews are to return to their land, it must be done entirely on their initiative. And there is a sharply anti-religious element in important sectors of the secular Zionist movement. There are even songs that religious Zionists still sing that are actually anti-religious songs. The most blatant of these is Which one am I thinking of? Yes. Yeah. It was Mi'im Halel. That's right. Absolutely. Mi'im Halel is an anti-religious song, which Rav Nosai I also sing. It's been amended a little bit in some Israeli yeshivas to make it more kosher. But Mi'im Halel, Kvod Yisrael, now in the original Pasuk, God is there, not Yisrael. Mi'im Halel, Kvod Hashem. It's true that Goel is used about a human being also in the davening about the Messiah, but here Goel Ha'am is not the Messiah either, or God. I think even Shema, which is the next word, here I can't prove this, is also a shtoch of sorts. Our Shema is not the religious Shema. This is not just a secular song. This is an anti-religious song. One can understand the hostility toward secular Zionism that pervaded much of the Orthodox community. Religious Zionists, on the other hand, attempted to preserve both human initiative and the belief in divine redemption. The Rambam himself is a complicated issue here, and this is not the time to discuss this. I once wrote something about this. The Rambam, as we've already seen, and there are other contexts as well where you see this, expected human initiative to be involved in the redemptive process, but at the same time, he told people to wait. He didn't want people to be overly excited about when the end of days would come because he considered this dangerous. So he wanted to avoid messianic, what he would have considered hysteria, and at the same time, however, to assume that the redemptive process would involve human initiative. There's a certain tension there. Religious Zionists, actually, many of them, appealed to the Rambam's perception of human initiative in the context of helping to bring about the redemption, something that he probably would not have endorsed in that form. But for religious Zionism, you have here an embrace of both horns of this dilemma, if you wish, and I don't know that it's really a dilemma. There is an embrace of both aspects, both of which are, I think, central to a proper Jewish worldview, and that is that it is our task to help within reasonable bounds of behavior and of reasonable bounds of hashkafa to attempt to bring about the conditions for the redemption. But the redemption, by its very terminology, is an act of God. And I will just end with an interpretation of a very famous pasuk that I once heard from an old line European rabbi who wouldn't have described himself as a Zionist, although he was a great lover of Israel. He was the rabbi of the shul where I daven, where I still daven most of the time, except on Yom HaTzma'ut, where I go elsewhere so that I can say Hallel, which backfired today, because when I went to the Yom Kippur of Kugel on the Hills today, which is where I go to daven on Yom HaTzmaut, it turned out that they had said Hallel, as I was as I feared, yesterday. But I got here in time to say Hallel with one of the later Minyanim and Reuben. But in any event, the rabbi of that shul, where they don't say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, was named Rabbi Golis. Was a Talmud of the Lublina Rav from Poland, was an Ibui, and so on and so forth. I don't think this is his original interpretation, but I heard it from him. And it's an interpretation of the verse, Shir HaMalos B'Shuv Hashem Nashiva Sion Toyinu Kichol, which we generally take to mean, and maybe this is the plain shot, that we will be in a kind of dreamlike state at that moment. He said it means something slightly different, and that is that when people imagine a utopia When people imagine a perfect world as communists did, as Marx did, and then they somehow bring that world that they imagined into existence, it ends up turning into a nightmare, which is what happened in the case of communism. And so the psalmist tells us that unlike this, Yeshuv Hashem Yeshiva Sion Hoyinu Kicholim, the reality will be the same as the dream.